Our teacher stood before his lectern again, saying, "We now have the third noble truth, one of the shortest and simplest of the truths. As Gotama taught, when one ceases to crave for a thing, then one ceases to have suffering connected with that thing. Suffering ceases with the complete cessation of cravings. A person who has cravings usually has cravings for another person's goods. He becomes covetous, he covets that possessed by another, he becomes infatuated with the possessions of another, and when he cannot have those things, resentment sets in and the person dislikes the owner of the coveted goods. That gives rise to frustration, anger, and pain. If one covets a thing which one cannot have, then there is unhappiness. Actions arising from cravings lead to unhappiness. Happiness is gained when one ceases to crave, when one takes life as it comes, the good with the bad." The Indian turned over his pages, shuffled about a bit, and then said, "Now we come to the fourth of the four noble truths, but the fourth of the four noble truths has been divided into eight parts called the Holy Eightfold Path. There are eight steps which one can take to obtain liberation from the desires of the flesh, to obtain liberation from cravings. We will go through them. The first is 1. The right viewpoint. As Gotama taught, one must have the right viewpoint on unhappiness. A person who feels miserable or unhappy must find out precisely why he is miserable or unhappy. He must investigate himself and find out what is the cause of this unhappiness. When a person has discovered for himself that which is causing unhappiness, then that person can do something about it to obtain the fourth of the four noble truths, which is, how can I find happiness? Before we can proceed upon life's journey with a tranquil mind and with a hope that we shall lead life as life is meant to be led, we must know what are our objectives. Which brings us to step 2 of the Holy Eightfold Path. 2. Right aspiration. Everyone aspires after something. It may be mental, physical, or spiritual gain. It may be to help others. It may be only to help ourselves. But, unfortunately, humans are in very much of a mess. They are undirected, confused, unable to perceive that which they should perceive. We have to strip away all the false values, all the false words, and to see clearly that which we are and that which we should be, as well as that which we desire. We must renounce false values which obviously lead us into unhappiness. Most people think only of I, me, and mine. Most people are too self-centered. They care not at all for the rights of others. It is essential that we look at ourselves as an object to be studied. Look at ourselves as we look at some stranger. Do you like the stranger? Would you like him to be your close friend? How would you like to live with him for a lifetime, eating with him, breathing with him, sleeping with him? You have to have the right aspirations before you can make a success of life, and from this right aspiration it follows that you must have 3. Right speech. This means that a person must control his speech, must not speak idle slander, must not deal with rumor as if rumor were fact. With right speech, one should always give the other person the benefit of the doubt, and should withhold speech when speech can harm another, giving speech when speech is good, when speech can help. Speech can be more deadly than the sword. Speech can be more poisonous than the most venomous poison. Speech can destroy a nation. Thus, one must have right speech, and right speech arises through 4. Right behavior. If one behaves in the correct way, one does not speak in an incorrect way. Thus, right behavior contributes materially to right speech and right aspirations. Right behavior means that a person does not tell lies, does not drink intoxicants, does not steal. Gotama taught that we are the result of our own thoughts. What we are now is that which our thoughts have caused us to be in the past. So if we think right now, if we behave right now, we will be right at some near future occasion. Gotama stated, "Hatred does not cease by hatred at any time. Hatred can only be conquered by love." He also said, "Let a man overcome the anger of another by love. Let him overcome the evil of another by his own good." As I was so often taught, one must not give proof of extrasensory abilities. One must not attack those who attack one, For according to the sayings of Gotama, one should not attack those who attack one with abusive language or with sticks or stones. Gotama said, if someone curses you, you must suppress all resentment and make firm determination that your mind shall not be disturbed and no angry word shall cross your lips. You will remain kind and friendly and without spite. Our Buddhist belief is of the middle way, a code of living, a code of doing to others as one would have done to oneself. The next of the Holy Eightfold Path. 5. Right livelihood. According to the teachings of Buddha, there were certain occupations which were harmful to a man, certain occupations which could not be followed by a true Buddhist. For instance, a true Buddhist could not be a butcher or the seller of poisons, nor could he be a slave trader or slave owner. A Buddhist could not partake of nor distribute liquors. The good Buddhist, at Gotama's time, was necessarily a man who wandered alone or lived in a monastery. 6. Right effort. Right effort has a special meaning. It means that one must proceed at one's own most suitable speed on the Holy Eightfold Path. A person who is seeking to progress should not be impatient and try to move too quickly before he has learned the lessons which are to be learned. But again, nor must that seeker try to hold back with false modesty, with false humility. A person can only progress at his own allotted speed. 7. Right mindfulness. It is the mind of man that controls man's actions. The thought is father to the deed. If you think of a thing, that is the first step to doing the thing, and some thoughts are very disharmonious. Physical desires might distract one and cause one harm. One might desire too much or too rich food. The desire does not give one the pain, but the overeating does. Unhappiness and pain develop from excessive eating, and follows the excessive desire to eat. The Buddhist must remember that feelings are short-lived, coming and going like the wind which changes at all times. Emotions are unstable things and cannot be relied upon. One must train oneself so that one has the right mindfulness at all times, irrespective of one's transient desires. 8. Right contemplation. As Gotama well knew, yoga was not by any means the answer to spiritual attainment. Yoga is merely a set of exercises which are designed to enable the mind to control the physical body. They are designed to subjugate the body at the mind's command. They are not designed to give one spiritual elevation. In right contemplation, one has to control irrelevant thoughts of the mind. One has to know one's own true needs. By having right contemplation, one could meditate, contemplate, so that without reasoning one could come to a conclusion by intuition as to what was right for oneself and what was wrong for oneself. The Indian teacher's voice stopped and he seemed to jerk back into the present. His eyes roved over us and then settled on me. "You," he said, pointing with outstretched finger. "I want a word with you. Come outside into the corridor." Slowly I got to my feet and made for the door. The Indian teacher followed and closed the door after him. Then he opened it again and put his head around the corner, saying, "You boys be silent, not a sound from you, I shall be just outside." He shut the door again and stood with his back to it. "Now, boy," he said, "you have been to see the Dalai Lama, what did he say to you?" "Honorable Master," I exclaimed, "I am enjoined not to repeat anything that happened, not to say a word that was passed." He turned on me in a fury and shouted, "I am your teacher, I command you to tell me. Did you mention me?" "I cannot tell you, sir," I said. "I can only repeat that I am forbidden to make any comment upon what passed. I shall report you for insolence and for disobedience, and for being in general a very unsatisfactory pupil." With that, he leaned forward and hit me violently on the left side and the right side of my head. He turned and entered the classroom, his face flaming with temper. I followed and resumed my place. The Indian teacher returned to his lectern and he then picked up his papers. He opened his mouth at the same instant as a lama entered. "Honored sir," said the lama to the Indian teacher, "I have to ask you to go to the Lord Abbot and I am instructed to continue with this lecture. If you will please indicate the point which you have reached, I shall be glad to continue." Sullenly the Indian teacher gave a rough summary of the position, and said that he was about to deal with Nirvana. Then he said, "It gives me much pleasure that I shall be leaving your class, and I hope my pleasure may be increased by not returning to it." With that he swirled all his papers into his leather bag, snapped it shut with a vicious clank, and swept out of the room, leaving the lama looking rather astonished at the display of temper. We smiled because we knew now that things would be better, for this fairly young lama was still young enough to understand the feelings of boys. "You fellows, how long have you been at this lecture? Have you had food?" he asked. "Do any of you want to leave for a few moments?" We all smiled back at him, and assured him that we were not anxious to leave just yet. So he nodded in a satisfied way while he went to the window and looked out for a moment or two. Chapter 6. The lama who was our new teacher pushed aside the lectern and sat down in the lotus position in front of us, sitting on a slightly raised platform which was present at all Tibetan lecture rooms. At our meals in our dining halls we had high lecterns at which a reader either sat or stood during meals, because at all times when we ate we were read to so that our minds should be filled with spiritual thoughts while our stomachs became filled with tsampa. It was not considered correct to eat and think of the food. It was the custom for formal lectures to be given with the lecturer standing at the lectern, and as we were quick to appreciate, the fact that our new teacher was sitting in front of us showed us that he was a different sort of a man. "Well," he said, "you have just been dealing with right mindfulness, and I hope that you are in the right frame of mind because the mind is the cause of most of man's distress. Physical desires can be very troublesome, particularly in a monastic community, particularly where the inmates are all celibate. Thus, it is necessary to control the mind, to create right mindfulness, because in creating right mindfulness we are able to avoid the unhappiness which arises when we desire all the things which we know quite well we cannot have. You know that the Buddha always taught that men particularly were often led astray by what one might term visual impact. Men, the average man, tends to idealize women." He looked at one rather big boy, and smiled as he said, "I know that a young gentleman such as you, who sometimes accompanies an older monk to the marketplace, might at times deserve to be called swivel eyes, but the Buddha taught that such things are not good for the monk because the desire is further to the action. The thought makes one do the things which one knows to be wrong." He looked at each of us and smiled as he said, "We should take the middle way, however, and not be too good and not be too bad. There is a story of a certain wayfarer who was traveling along a road, some time before he had seen a very beautiful young woman pass, and he was most anxious to make her acquaintance. Unfortunately, he had had to step aside into the bushes for a purpose which we need not discuss, and he feared that in the interval the young woman must have passed him by. He saw an old Buddhist monk coming along, and he stopped him saying, 'Will you tell me, honorable master, have you seen a very beautiful young woman passing this way in your travels?' The old monk looked blankly at him and replied, 'A beautiful young woman? That I cannot tell you. I have been trained in right mindfulness, therefore it is that I can only tell you that a set of bones passed me some time ago, whether it was that of a man or of a woman I cannot say, for it was of no interest to me.'" The lama chuckled as he said, "That is right mindfulness carried beyond all reasonable limits, carried in fact to an absurd extent. However, let us carry on with a subject which is very, very much misunderstood." He went on to tell us that the Eightfold Path had an objective under which those who followed that path would attain a very desired end, would attain nirvana. Nirvana actually means the cessation of craving, the end of resentment and covetousness. The end of covetousness and the other lusts of the body would enable a man or a woman to attain to a state of bliss. Nirvana is liberation from the body, liberation from the lusts and gluttonies of the flesh. It does not by any means imply the cessation of all experience, nor does it mean the cessation of all knowledge nor the cessation of all life. It is incorrect to say that nirvana means existing in a state of nothingness. That is an error which has been perpetrated through ignorant people talking about things which they did not at all understand. Nirvana is freedom from lust, freedom from the various hungers of the flesh. Nirvana is not just blissful contemplation, it is, instead, a fulfillment of spiritual knowledge and liberation from all bodily desires. The state of nirvana is being in a pure state, pure so far as lack of lusts for physical things are concerned. But even when one has attained to nirvana, that is freedom from flesh desires, one still goes on to learn spiritual things and to advance in other planes of existence. Buddhists believe in the round of becoming. They believe that mankind is born to earth, lives on earth, and then dies, and then comes back to earth in a different body, that it is reborn to earth so that lessons not learned during a past life can be assimilated. Nirvana is not a place, it is not a place that you can pin down on a map. It is a state of mind, a condition of mind. It is the condition of being thoughtful. Thoughtfulness is one of the chief virtues of a good Buddhist, while thoughtlessness is abhorred. Nirvana does not mean the loss of personal consciousness at the cessation of life upon earth, it means quite the reverse. There is also a further nirvana which in the Indian language is called parinirvana. A good Buddhist, said our Lama teacher, is a truly happy person, a person who is concerned with helping others, a person who has thought for others. The good Buddhist does not respect or recognize the titles or castes existing in countries such as India, for a man does not attain to a state of happiness by the estate of his parents. A prince could be unhappy, while a beggar could be happy. Birth does not enable one to discover how to defeat the suffering, the state of one's parents' purse had nothing to do with it. The only way to seek liberation from unwholesome desires is by following the practical eightfold path which gives one self-knowledge, and as one has self-knowledge, one can have lasting happiness. The Lama looked at each of us and said, I suppose you think that we Buddhists have the greatest number of followers of any religion in the world, you think we are the most important. Well, that is not correct, because at the present time only one-fifth of the population of this world are Buddhists. We have Buddhists in Thailand, Ceylon, Burma, China, Japan, Korea, Tibet, and a certain number in India. There are many different forms of Buddhism, and they all spring from the same source, wherefore it is clear that there should not be friction between us, springing as we do from the same parent. We can each think in our own way. Much later in our lectures we shall deal with the uses of religion, but for the moment I want you to recite the refuges. The three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the doctrine. I take refuge in the order. The Lama said, you boys must say that in the morning and before retiring at night. You must get it impressed upon your subconscious. You can call it a symbolization of the great renunciation which the founder of Buddhism made when he left the family palace and took up his monk's robe. You boys, he continued, will be renouncing the lures of the flesh. You will be training to be young men of good character, of good conduct, young men of pure thought, for in the days which shall come upon our country, days of sorrow, days of overshadowing evil, for terrible things shall come to pass in our beloved country, it will be necessary for young men of good character to go out into what, to us, is the great unknown and to keep our own culture alive. Therefore, it is that you of this generation must study and purify yourselves, for we of the older generation shall not be able to follow you. He told us, in your travels you will meet many Zen Buddhists. You will wonder if their austerities are necessary, for to the Zen Buddhist all those who teach and all that which teaches, such as books or scriptures, are only pointers like a finger outstretched, pointing the path that one shall take. Think of the people you have seen, think as you look down upon our pilgrims walking around the ring road, observe how when some guide or gypsy points to a thing, like one of us at our windows, how a pilgrim's eyes invariably follow and look at the pointing finger rather than the object at which it is pointed. It is a fact that the ignorant always look at the pointing finger rather than in the direction that the finger indicates. This is a fact which was known to the sect of Buddhism which became known as the Zen Buddhists. It is their belief that one can only know truth by one's personal experience of truth. Truth cannot be known by just listening to the spoken word, nor by reading the printed page. One can only profit by actual personal experiences. One is enjoined to read, to study the scriptures, and to listen with attention to the learned lectures of wise men. But all the printed words and all the written words must serve merely as fuel for the workings of one's own mind, so that when one gets an experience, one can relate that experience to great truths as propounded by others. He smiled and said, "All this means that you cannot get far by being a mere theorist. You have to be a practical man as well as a student of the written word. It is stated that one picture is worth more than a thousand words, but I say that one experience is worth more than a thousand pictures." He hesitated for a moment, and turned and looked out of the window. My heart leapt because I thought that perhaps he would see my guide the Lama Minyadon up returning from the wild rose fence Lamazuri. But no. He just turned back to us again and said, "I am going to tell you something which undoubtedly will shock you and make you think that Zen Buddhists are uncultured savages, and sacrilegious savages at that. Some time ago in Japan there was a very famous teacher indeed, a man who was revered for his high ideals, for his profound knowledge, and for the austere manner of his living. Students came from all over the Eastern world to bow at that master's feet and study under him. One day he was giving a very special lecture in one of the ceremonial temples, a temple adorned by many statues of the thousand Buddhas, statues cunningly carved from rare exotic woods. The teacher had the enthralled attention of his students, and then he paused in the middle of his lecture and his students held their breath wondering what he was going to say, because he had, deservedly, a reputation for being very, very eccentric. As this wise man turned aside and seized the nearest of the wooden Buddhas and threw it in the fire, the students rose in shocked horror. For a moment there was a babble of conversation, protests, waving hands, and scuffling feet. But the wise man stood calmly with his back to the fire, stood with his back to the blazing statue of the Buddha. When the commotion had ceased, he said that everyone has statues in their minds, everyone sets up ornaments, idols, useless things which occupy space in the mind just as useless wooden idols occupy space in a temple. As he said, the only way to progress is to burn up the clutter in one's mind, destroy that which impedes progress. The great teacher turned and rubbed a finger over one of the higher Buddhas. He turned back to the class and said, "Here there be dust, dust upon a Buddha, but that is not so bad as dust upon the mind. Let us destroy carved images. Let us destroy false ideas that live within us, for unless one clears out one's untidy mind as one clears out an untidy attic, one cannot progress and go on to the higher reaches of the path." Our Lama teacher laughed outright at our shocked expressions. He said, "Oh, you are a conservative lot. Wait until you get out to some of the other Lamazuris, wait until you move among the people. You will find that some have no use for the teachings of religion, and you will find yet others who wash out their mouth before speaking the name of the Buddha, wash their mouth so that their mouth shall be clean before uttering a sacred name. But these are extremes, those who make a fetish of it and those who have no use for religion. Religion is a discipline which is only of use if one uses common sense, moderation, and the middle way, and then religion can solve all one's problems. I do not know, but I suppose I must have grunted or made some sign which attracted his attention, for he hesitated a moment and then slowly came over and stood in front of me and looked down. "Lobsang," he said, "you appear to be very troubled. You have had a most trying experience today. But from your expression I am sure that there is more troubling you than that, and I am sure also that it is even more serious than that your guide has not returned, and will not return, this day. Tell me what it is." I wished the floor would open and drop me all the way through, right down into one of the volcanic chambers. Because I had to admit to myself I had been thinking rather unusual things. To be quite blunt, I was heartily sick of the way I had to live, and I thought that now was the time perhaps. "Let us get it over with, honorable master," I said with some trepidation. "It is true that I am dissatisfied. My mind is in conflict, my thoughts are in turmoil, for I am being driven to take a course of action which is not at all in accordance with my own desires. I have been sorely troubled, and as I sat upon the golden roof struggling with the wind, thinking that death awaited me, I was glad because I thought that death would bring the end of my problems." The Lama teacher looked at me with sympathy. He drew his robe around him and sat on the floor beside me, crossing his legs and settling himself in the lotus posture. "Lobsang," he said, "let us discuss this problem, and I suggest that we discuss it with this class because I have no doubt that many of the young men here are similarly troubled at some time or other. I have been at the Potala a long, long time, and perhaps your own problems now may have been my problems in days gone by." "Honorable teacher," I replied, "I have no choice. I had to leave my wealthy home. I was driven out by my parents, who were very powerful people indeed, and I was told that I was to be trained in the priesthood. Because I came of a high family, I had to undergo more trials and tribulations than had I come from a low family. I had more to learn, I had more to suffer. My left leg was burned to the bone through no fault of mine. Both my legs were broken when I was blown off the mountain in a gale, but although I can barely hobble, although I suffer constant pain, I still have to attend classes. Now, honorable teacher, I have never wanted to be a monk, but I have had no choice in what I wanted. I have been forced to do it. Religion offers me nothing." The Lama looked at me with a lot of understanding and said, "But, Lobsang, these are early days. Religion will offer you a lot when you understand the workings of the middle way and the rules of this life and the life beyond. Then you will become tranquil and will understand much more what life really is. But at your present stage, what do you want to be?" I looked out from the golden roof and I saw the boatman on the happy river, and I thought, what a free life that is, how pleasant just paddling backwards and forwards on a river which everyone loves, meeting interesting people, people who come from India, people who are going to China, people who are going beyond the mountains to return at some time with strange knowledge and strange artifacts. But I am just a boy stuck here, subject to discipline, not able to do anything that I want to do, always having to obey orders, always having to learn things in which I am not interested, always being told that my life will be hard but that I am working for a special purpose, that I am going to do a special task." I stopped and wiped my brow with my sleeve, then continued, "Why do I always have to have such hardship?" The teacher put a hand on my shoulder and said, "All life is like this classroom. You come here, some of you reluctantly, some of you gladly, but you all come here to learn things, and each of you must learn at your own rate because no one, no teacher, can force your development, for to do so would mean that you had an imperfect knowledge of the subject. You have to progress at your own rate, fast or slow according to your own capabilities, according to your own desire for knowledge. All life is like a classroom. You come to this life as you come to this class. But when you leave this classroom in several minutes' time, it will be the same as dying to this life, dying to the classroom. Perhaps tomorrow you will go to a different classroom, which is much the same as being reborn, reborn in a different body, in different conditions, with different circumstances. You do not know what the teacher is going to teach you, you do not know why the teacher is going to teach you, but when in years to come you go out into the great world beyond our range of mountains, you will find that the things you have learned in this classroom and in other classrooms will help you enormously in ways which you cannot at present comprehend. That is what my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, always tells me," I replied. "But I still do not know how I can reconcile myself to doing something which makes me unhappy." The teacher looked about to see what the other boys were doing. But the others were all intent. They were interested because it seemed that they all had problems similar to my own. We boys had all been put in lamasaries without any choice of our own. In my own case, I entered when I was 7. These boys were listening now. We were all, in fact, like people groping in total darkness hoping for a ray of light to guide us. Our teacher continued, "You must decide what paths there are open to you. You, Lobsang, can stay here and be a monk, or you can leave and be a boatman, or a maker of kites, or a traveler to lands beyond the mountains. But you cannot be all of them at the same time. You must decide what you are going to be. If you are going to be a boatman, then leave this lamasery now and think no more of this lamasery, think no more of being a monk, think only of being a boatman. But if you are going to be a monk, as indeed is your destiny, then forget about being a boatman, Devote the whole of your thought to being a monk. Devote the whole of your thought to studying how to be a good monk. And the more you think about being a good monk, the easier it will be for you." One of the other boys broke in, saying excitedly, "But, Honorable Master, I, too, had to enter a Lamasery against my own wishes.